FPL now says buried lines might be a good idea. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, there were angry FPL customers after Irma. There was even a lawsuit. The utility defends its performance after the storm and trying to get power back to the residents of South Florida. But we're going to talk with the state official charged with protecting customers, and we're going to hear his take on FPL's performance. And then, of course, we're going to hear from the utility company. President Trump says he wants to protect DACA recipients, but he wants a lot of concessions for extending the program or supporting another one like it. What's the response from the Catholic Church here in South Florida, one of the biggest supporters of DACA kids and refugees? All of that and more coming up today on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We are almost a month removed from Hurricane Irma here in South Florida, and there are still reminders with those large piles of debris and downed trees that still need to be picked up. There are also conversations about the way the utility that serves Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties, Florida Power and Light, handled itself during and after the storm. Now, one of the conversations getting a lot of traction, the debate about above-ground power lines compared to buried power lines. So are you living in a community with buried power lines? Did that make a difference for you after Irma? Are you willing to pay more for those buried lines because it will be an extra cost? And how long did it take for you to get your power back after the hurricane? Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. We are going to hear from the utility company here today, but first, I want to turn things over to J.R. Kelly. He's with the Florida Office of Public Counsel. This is the group charged with basically defending you, the consumer, when it comes to dealing with the utility company. Mr. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on today.
All right. So here we are a month after Irma. Do you know, do you have a final number for how many people lost power and for how long?
No, sir. Those figures, my best guesstimate would be it'll still take a month or so to put all the figures of how many people lost power, and more importantly, what I'll be looking at is how much are the storm restoration costs that the utilities are going to ask ratepayers to pay.
What was your biggest concern about FPL's recovery efforts right after the storm?
I think initially was, and again, this is all what I read in the press, is the breakdown in the communications that the high-profile systems that ratepayers have paid for failed to communicate accurate information or any information. I read reports where some customers called and they were told that their power had been restored. They checked out of their hotel rooms, traveled back to their homes, and lo and behold, they had no power, and some for a matter of days. And so that is certainly a huge concern amongst many right now that we're going to be looking into.
Now, your office, didn't it encourage customers without power to file complaints?
Absolutely, and we're still doing that today. The Public Service Commission, which is a state agency charged with regulating the utilities such as Florida Power and Light, Duke Energy, et cetera, has opened a docket, and they want all customers that have any kind of story to tell to please file complaints. It doesn't have to be a complaint. It can be an inquiry. We want to know what happened, what you experienced. And if customers don't take the time to respond, then in many cases we'll never know the true story.
FPL says that it spent billions to put some of the lines underground, put in concrete poles, add smart meters, that they strengthened the system. They said their response time was better than that after Wilma a decade ago. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think in some instances, I do believe the response time was probably better. In others, I just don't know. And that'll be part of the fact-finding that the commission will be undertaking. And certainly we have already intervened in the docket on behalf of all the ratepayers, and those are some of the hard questions we're going to be getting into. I want to know, where did the money get spent? Now, I can tell you that the ratepayers have paid billions of dollars for what were supposed to be storm hardening activities. That's some of the things we're going to get into. One, where was the money spent? Two, what was it spent for? And three, if it was spent in that area, in a particular area, did that equipment fail? Did it hold up? Why in both instances? Why or why not? This is not going to be an overnight investigation. It's going to take several months, I do believe.
The Senate Communications, Energy, and Public Utilities Committee is going to be hearing a presentation from FPL pretty soon. Isn't that correct?
Yes, sir. There are actually three or four committee meetings this week in the Senate and the House of Representatives, and they are scheduled to hear from the utilities, from the Public Service Commission, and I believe also some of the insurance companies as to, okay, tell us exactly what happened, what worked, what didn't, and again, we want to get down to the why. My goal is very clear. I don't want ratepayers having to pay any costs that are not prudent and reasonable on behalf of the utilities and what they're spending. But more importantly, I'd like to see what improvements can be made so that customers don't go through the long waiting times for either response or to get their power back on when a hurricane hits again. And we all know it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
So do you expect FPL and other utility companies to pass some of that recovery expense on to the customer?
Yes, sir. And they are allowed to do that under law. They are allowed to ask for special recovery of any expenses directly attributable to damages caused by a named hurricane. So that's obviously going to be one of the major components that we're going to be looking at because it's tough. It's a tough analysis because what you're trying to decide is a certain expense directly attributable to that storm, or is it part of the normal operating and maintenance expenses that a utility undertakes, which in that case they're already collecting in their current rates and they're not entitled to any further recovery.
Let me finish up on this. People were talking about, I remember, you know, after the hurricane, we were on air talking to all of our listeners about their experiences and what was going on in the recovery. We heard this over and over again about going to the underground lines instead of the overhead lines, and that would, of course, cost more for the customers. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it can be a double-edged sword. In some areas, undergrounding probably would make sense. But I need to warn the listeners, it is not an end-all to the problems of outages. Number one, you may have flooding. That's what happened up in the north several years ago, is when you have underground lines and you have flooding, you cannot get to the lines in some cases to repair them, so the outage could be even longer. And we all know Florida is our elevation is about at sea level, in some cases below sea level. So that presents a challenge. And the other thing to consider is just because lines are underground in a particular neighborhood, let's say, the lines that come in and connect are overhead. I live in Tallahassee. We have underground power lines in my neighborhood. We lost power. Why? Because the transmission lines coming into the neighborhood were knocked down by trees. And so even though my neighbors and I had underground power lines, we had no electricity to get to the line. So it can be a double-edged sword as to, you know, which one is better. And I think it all depends on the geography and where you may be situated.
J.R. Kelly is with the Florida Office of Public Counsel, again charged with protecting consumers when dealing with the utility companies. Mr. Kelly, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right. I want to turn things over now to the public utility that serves most of us here in South Florida, Florida Power and Light, and talk a little bit about the issue of Hurricane Irma recovery. And again, there were people without power for at least a week, maybe a little bit more. But let's get to them. By the way, we're going to take to your calls here in just a moment, 800-743-9576. What were some of the challenges that you faced? Did you have power back quickly? Did it take a while? What were some of your biggest concerns? Let me turn things over now to Chris McGrath. He is a spokesperson for FPL. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it very much.
All right. Well, Chris, I mean, look, you heard everything that Mr. Kelly said. I want to give you a chance to respond.
Well, I mean, I think first and foremost, it's important. I know Hurricane Irma feels like it was just yesterday, but it's worth recapping just how unprecedented this storm was. You know, quite frankly, something that we've never really seen before in our state's history. You know, from an FPL perspective, this impacted more than 4.4 million customer accounts. And we serve nearly 5 million across the state, so you see the significant impact here. But the point I want to make is the investments we've made since the brutal 2004-05 hurricane season, the billions of dollars we've invested on behalf of customers to make our grid stronger and to make it smarter showed once again that it's continuing to pay off for customers with tangible benefits. These investments, without a doubt, shaved days off the restoration. And we know for some customers, they had prolonged outages, and we know that it's terribly difficult to be without power for an extended period of time. And we know that we're not perfect, and there is room to improve, but by and large, from a grid performance standpoint, especially when you benchmark this to Hurricane Wilma, which was the last hurricane that we experienced before making these investments, it is clear from the early data that we have that these investments made a big difference for customers.
Well, and we were lucky in that we didn't get the real brunt of the storm. It could have been a direct hit. So this is what we experienced. We had up to 99-100-mile-an-hour winds here. It's not to say, but it wasn't the Category 5 people thought might hit a few days before the storm. But if this is what we experienced, what does that tell you about the grid as you have it? Because it could have been worse. Can it handle it? Can it really handle a 4 or 5?
Well, you know, the thing is this is still a significant storm. I mean, you're talking hurricane force gusts, sustained tropical storm force winds for a period, in some cases, of 24 hours. And so that's what's so unique about Wilma, wasn't just the size, wasn't just the strength, but it was the duration. And so, you know, we know that we've invested this money on behalf of customers to strengthen the grid, but you can't stop a tree from knocking down a power line. It's sort of like the building codes that have improved tremendously since Hurricane Andrew 25 years ago. You can strengthen your home. You can make it as hurricane resilient as possible. But if a tree falls on your roof, it's going to do a tremendous amount of damage. And so that's really what we saw with Hurricane Irma. You know, most of the damage caused and what caused the majority of outages was really tree limbs and, in fact, whole trees and other debris blowing into our lines.
Let me ask you about trees. There is a class action lawsuit against FPL. I'm sure you can't answer it. If you can, please do. But it was about collecting storm charge fees to allow for trees near power lines to be pruned. So how is that process, what's that process supposed to be? And is it calling on you and FPL and saying, hey, are those trees pruned? Are we ready? Or is that on somebody else?
Well, I mean, listen, we have an extensive vegetation management program. And in fact, that's part of, you know, the billions of dollars we've invested. That is included in those dollar figures. You know, we trim thousands upon thousands of miles of vegetation away from power lines throughout the year to make sure we're not only ready for storm season, but even afternoon thunderstorms. But the fact of the matter is that tree maintenance is a shared responsibility between FPL, our customers, and all the communities we serve. And it really starts with planting the right tree in the right place. It's something that we really have stressed to customers during normal blue sky days, as we call it. And then following the storm, I think it's given a heightened awareness around how important it is to make sure that you're planting trees away from lines.
All right, let's get to the other part of the story that we had mentioned before, is the underground line. So you heard about it throughout the post-storm period, that week after, people saying, why not have more underground lines? FPL now saying it's looking more into that. But what is the deal with deciding where you're going to put underground lines, or if you can?
Yeah, you know, and I think Mr. Kelly really he kind of summed it up a little bit, but I can reiterate, you know, from an FPL perspective, we have long supported undergrounding of power lines. In fact, many folks may not even realize that following Hurricane Wilma, we actually advocated for and implemented incentives to promote and really encourage communities to initiate more undergrounding. And as you mentioned, we are now evaluating opportunities to incorporate undergrounding into our next phase of hardening improvements across the 35 counties we serve, of course, including down here in South Florida. But the big thing, as a rate-regulated utility, it's important that customers realize that when we go ahead and build new service and upgrade our infrastructure, we still have to deliver power to customers cost-effectively using the most cost-effective option.
And underground
and more
lines,
times than not,
underground lines cost more. And so that, and that's something you're going to have to put on those communities. Do people understand that? Have you told them that? Do you explain what the cost is?
Absolutely. You know, and we work with communities who want to put lines underground. Like I said, I mean, we advocated for and implemented incentives, but the key is making sure that communities understand that if they want to put those underground lines in their neighborhoods, in their cities, in their counties, they have to come up with the extra cost, the difference between the overhead and the underground. But it's a reason why, you know, 90% of new construction in Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade counties, 90% of the new construction has underground lines because it's a little bit cheaper if you do it up front as opposed to a conversion.
Should FPL pay more of that than the customer? Because you are protecting your lines. It's your infrastructure.
Sure. You know, like I said, you know, we have advocated for, we've implemented incentives to encourage customers and really municipalities to put those lines underground. Depending on the size and the scope of a project, you know, that discount can be up to 25%. And like I said, it comes back to being a rate-regulated utility. Everything we do is governed by the Florida Public Service Commission, and we have a duty to provide reliable service at the lowest possible cost. And just pure math, overhead is just more cost-effective than underground.
All right. I just want to take a couple of quick calls here before we finish up this segment. I want to go to Sergio, who's been waiting in Miami. Sergio, thanks for holding on. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My comment is I do live in an area where we made the decision to do the conversion to underline, and during the storm, seems like a lot of the bigger trees got uprooted and affected the boards underneath, and therefore the outage for us was somewhere in the range of 7 days, and a lot of people in my association area felt like that cost, that surcharge, wasn't really worth it. It was just the question that was being thrown around. And one last comment is, I live in an association area, and it seemed like there wasn't enough cohesiveness between FPL and the county, where I live in Cutler Bay, the county of Cutler Bay, in deciding who was going to be responsible for tree removals in a timely manner, which further delayed the time without power.
Okay. Well, Sergio, let me give him a chance. Thank you so much for the comment. All right, so two quick things on that point is, one is trees get uprooted. Without getting too technical, I mean, how deep are you burying lines and how often is that a problem? All right, do I still have, you know what? I think I lost. All right. Well, we did lose Mr. McGrath from FPL. I'll take one more call here real quickly before we finish up. I've got Bob in Fort Lauderdale. Bob, thank you so much for holding on. Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a quick comment. During Irma, we did not lose any power, and we were underground wiring. So we felt like we were in an island because everybody else around us was without power. Our subdivision that I live in, we all had power, but as soon as you went out of the gates of the subdivision, there was no power anywhere. So I was just making a comment that maybe it does work.
Interesting. All right. Hey, Bob, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Really appreciate that. You know what? You can share your thoughts, your ideas. Always find us online. Again, you can find us on Facebook. Look up WLRN Sundial. Find us on Twitter. Our handle is at WLRN Sundial. And again, I lost Chris McGrath. He's a spokesperson for FPL, but he did share with us some basic information about what they're looking into when it comes to the underground, putting the lines underground, I should say. We also heard from J.R. Kelly of the Florida Office of Public Counsel a little bit earlier as well. So a story that we'll continue to follow. When they'll have a final report for everybody to see, to say this is kind of what happened, I mean, we'll be on them. And we'll wait and see. But as Mr. Kelly said, it could be many, many months. All right, we're going to move on here. We're going to come back in just a moment. And we're going to have a sit-down conversation with Archbishop Thomas Wenske of the Miami Archdiocese. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, this weekend, the White House announced that the administration will support protecting kids under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals only if there's stronger security at the border, making it harder for children to come into this country illegally, and Congress comes up with the money for a border wall. That's just to name a few of the conditions. Critics say these are unreasonable and will leave a lot of children vulnerable. Someone who has been vocal about protecting immigrants is Archbishop Thomas Wentzke of the Miami Archdiocese. That includes Miami-Dade, Broward, and Monroe counties. Now, this week, Catholic bishops here in the U.S. are pressing a new campaign by Pope Francis to bring attention to the plight of refugees and immigrants. And we're joined now in studio by the Archbishop to talk about this issue and so much more on Sundial. Archbishop Wentzke, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Louis. It's very very nice to be here with you and with the listeners of WLRN, and it's a great issue to talk about.
Well, let's get started right on what the White House had pressed yesterday on the issue again of DACA, the Deferred Action for Children or Childhood Arrivals. The president wants to harden the border against thousands of more kids fleeing violence in Central America before making any deal. What's your response to this?
Well, I didn't get a chance to read the entire document that the White House put out because it's a quite thorough one with a whole menu of policy suggestions or changes that they want to make that would be toughening or tightening up what they call the loopholes. And it's almost like they're throwing the whole kitchen sink at DACA. Something as large as what the White House proposed would be a good way to start discussion over comprehensive immigration reform, something that I would cover a whole enchilada, as it were, and not just a small segment, a kind of a boutique issue, which is the DACA. The DACA children are sympathetic. I think even President Trump has been sympathetic to them, saying that he wants to work out a deal that would allow them to stay here permanently. And what they suggested as conditions for this is a little bit lots.
I've always been curious as to how the church gets involved in these issues without getting too political. But immigration is a passion of yours, but it's also a very heated, hotly debated topic today.
Well, again, I think the reason why the church is involved in it is because it touches human beings. It touches human dignity and human life. It touches human flourishing, because without legal status, the bar to human flourishing is set very low for many people. The reason why people come here oftentimes is because they're seeking conditions worthy of human life. So anything that touches on what is human really concerns the church. And what the church is trying to remind people is that immigrants are not a problem. And unfortunately, that's how they're viewed. And I think that's kind of a reductive way of thinking. And when we allow ourselves to engage in such way of thinking to reduce human beings to being problems, that invites us to seek solutions and sometimes even final solutions, as we learned in the last century. So immigrants themselves are not a problem. They're human beings, and they might be a stranger, but a stranger that should be embraced as a brother or sister. Now, immigration is problematic. There's a lot of problems dealing with our broken immigration system. And what we have to be careful of is not to blame the victims, because the immigrants themselves are as much the victim of a broken immigration system as the rest of the country is also in some ways victimized by a system that is inefficient and inadequate.
How often do you run into members of the church who they have issues with this? Because maybe they may be members of the church or the Catholic Church, but yeah, you have Republicans, you have Democrats. They may stand on different sides of this topic, and well, they're going to hold to those beliefs.
Well, I think generally speaking, the even right now, prescinding from a religious affiliation, most Americans are open to a a reform of our immigration system. Not everybody wants to deport 12 million people. The majority would like to figure out a system that would accommodate them and perhaps keep others from coming later on. But but to your point, again, you know, the church is in the world, but oftentimes the world is in the church. And so sometimes we have people in the church that think in worldly ways. And to consider human beings as problems is one of those worldly ways that I think we should avoid. Again, the system is broken. We have to fix the system. And when we talk about comprehensive immigration reform, what we've been talking about for the past 15, 16 years or more has been a reform that would address three basic issues. One, that would address the 11 million that have come here, that are already living here, many of whom have American citizen children, American citizen spouses, that are already integrated into the fabric of American society, yet they do not have a permanent legal status. We have to figure out a system to afford them that legal status. The next thing is that a lot of times people have come here because they've been drawn here by the possibility of work. And for decades now, if you survived that gauntlet, the dangerous gauntlet of passing through the border of Mexico into Arizona or Texas, you could find a job. And immigration is a reality in all 50 states. And the immigrants are not the ones that you find sleeping under bridges. They're working, and they might be working in onion fields in New York State or in dairy farms in New Hampshire and even out to Alaska. So they're working. So what we have to have is a system that would allow immigrants or to access that work, or to allow American businesses to be honest and to hire, if they need immigrant labor, to hire them in a legal way and not just have this underground economy that, or underground system that is bringing in illegal workers. And the third thing, basically, is the family. And we have to try to keep families together, and immigration reform should make it easier for family members that are separated because of immigration to reunite.
Staying with the White House, too, the White House has, as you've heard for months now, has demanded, you know, also including funding cuts for so-called sanctuary cities, you know, certain block grants and other federal aid. Mayor Carlos Jimenez has said Miami is not a sanctuary city, but it's not really clear what the definition is and how other communities here might be affected. So I wondered, are you worried about people here in South Florida potentially losing out on federal aid over this debate?
I don't think so, because as you said, Mayor Jimenez went very public to say that he was not that Miami-Dade was not a sanctuary city, and the term sanctuary city really is a very elastic one. It means different things to different people. Sanctuary in itself comes from a medieval concept where somebody that was running away from a king or a prince could seek sanctuary in a church and be protected from arrest. That is from the Middle Ages, but it has no legal standing in the United States. So it's a term of art, but it's not very precise.
Well, isn't the idea that in a particular city that undocumented immigrants could be protected from ICE agents from the federal government to an extent?
Well, I think what the purpose, what the idea is or has been, is that immigration should be the domain of the federal government, and the federal government should not recruit local police agencies to do or to enforce immigration laws. And there's a very cogent reason for this, is that in neighborhoods, when somebody is a victim of a crime or when somebody sees a crime, you want that person to feel comfortable enough about calling the local policeman or policewoman to report that crime, so that the evildoer, the violator of the crime can be apprehended. If the immigrant, because of irregular status or because he has a relative in his living in his house that's in a regular status, if he sees a crime or is victim of a crime, he might be reluctant to call the police if the police have now become the enforcers of immigration law. So let ICE do immigration and let police do public safety.
What's the church's position on providing sanctuary to undocumented immigrants if they come to you and say, well, we need help?
Well, we try to help them. We have a legal services here in the Archdiocese of Miami, several offices in Broward County here in Miami that provide legal services either free or at low cost to immigrants trying to sort out their immigration issues. We try to do that. But, we'll help people, but to say, well, come and live in my church, that's not a solution. It's not a solution for anybody because that person doesn't need to live in a church. They need to support their families. They need to work. They need to, go to school, et cetera. So, hiding out in a church, that's almost like making your church another prison for ICE, because if they're hiding out there, they're not going to be able to go out and circulate in society. So it's not a practical or real solution. What the solution is really immigration reform. It's in Congress that it has to come from.
We're talking with Archbishop Thomas Wenske of the Miami Archdiocese. Again, that's from Miami-Dade, Broward, and Monroe counties. Archbishop, Pope Francis has called on Catholics to pay special attention to the needs of refugees over the next 2 years. Bishops in the U.S. have declared this week to start that process, to put a focus on this mission. So what are the people here in South Florida doing?
Well, we have several Know Your Rights programs that we're trying to get introduced to several parishes so that the local priests can invite their parishioners to a safe place, and if they can, if they have concerns about their immigration status or what their rights might be if they are stopped by ICE or by somebody else, we will try to inform them of that. The other thing is again, we're trying to help change minds and hearts. Pope Francis began this on the 27th of September with an event and. In front of St. Peter's, where he embraced a refugee family. That same day, I went to my cathedral, where I have a family that are refugees from Pakistan, and I met with them and embraced them. And this is an important thing. Here in Miami, we're all, we're a big immigrant city, and a lot of people here are refugees. But again, refugee refers to those people that are seeking asylum, and the U.S. government this year under the present administration reduced the number of refugees that it would accept. In previous years, we were accepting over 100,000 a year. Now, this year, it'll probably be less than 50,000. And this is at a time when there are 65 million refugees or displaced persons in the world. This is the greatest number of refugees in the world since the end of World War II. And in the United States, we are capable of doing much better, and we did much better. In the late 70s and the 80s, millions of Vietnamese boat people were resettled throughout the world, but also here to the United States. And that was a very humanitarian and a generous response of Western countries to a real crisis in Southeast Asia with the numbers of Vietnamese that were traveling. And now we have a similar crisis in the Middle East with the Syrians especially and some Iraqis, etc. And we should try to do an equally generous response.
All right, I want to take a moment here, just a quick break, and come back because when we talk about a group of people, we're going to start seeing a lot more coming to Florida. Puerto Ricans, folks who were devastated by Hurricane Maria. Again, talking with Archbishop Thomas Wenske of the Miami Archdiocese. More conversation with him coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined by Archbishop Thomas Wenske of the Miami Archdiocese. We were talking about refugees. I want to switch over to evacuees because these are not refugees. Puerto Ricans suffered greatly from Hurricane Maria, and still much of the island's just trying to get power back. But we've already started seeing a number of Puerto Ricans. They came on a cruise ship last week to Port Everglades. We're going to start. We've heard people are talking about leaving the island because it could take a long time before that island gets back to normal. We're going to start seeing more of them come now to Florida.
And in fact, at Miami International Airport, there are tables set up to receive Puerto Ricans that are disembarking from flights from Puerto Rico to help orientate them to their needs here in the United States. Catholic Charities, Red Cross, and other groups are out there. Sometimes we're assisting them, perhaps with a meal ticket or bus fare if they want to find a relative someplace that we can get them to their relatives. Of course, the Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, so they're not immigrants in the way we would understand them, understand immigrants. They're U.S. citizens that they don't need a passport to be here, and they're can work here legally, et cetera, et cetera. But there will be a growing number here. And Puerto Ricans have been coming to South Florida or to Florida for the past several years in great numbers.
Because of the economic situation.
Because of the economics. And right now, I think there are about 1.2 million Puerto Ricans living in the state of Florida. And that's almost as many as there are Cubans living in Florida. So this is going
to
grow.
What are the services that you expect to provide? Are you making room in schools for students at the local Catholic colleges and so forth?
We have accommodated some kids already from Puerto Rico into our schools, and I'm sure in the coming weeks we'll be receiving many more. And, of course, the public school system is also embracing them as they come here. It'll be a long-term issue. Look at New Orleans after Katrina. New Orleans lost a good part of its population. Many of them fled to Houston, and in the aftermath of Katrina, they stayed in Houston. So a lot of the people that will be moving out of Puerto Rico will probably come here. Some will go back to Puerto Rico when conditions permit, but you can expect that many of them will stay here.
Do you expect to see the same thing that we saw when Cubans were in flight from Cuba many, many decades ago?
No, I don't. It's apples and oranges because, as I said, the Puerto Ricans are already U.S. citizens. They have access to American society. Most of them have relatives already living here. So there's support systems that are already in place that perhaps was not the same as when Mariel happened, et cetera. And again, they're coming in on regularly scheduled flights. It's easy to kind of anticipate that. There's not going to be a huge exodus. Puerto Rico's quite a ways away, so people are not going to be arriving on rickety boats. And I think the cruise ships are probably at the end of their humanitarian efforts. It'll be most people coming here by plane.
Archbishop Thomas Wenske of the Miami Archdiocese, again covering Miami-Dade, Broward, and Monroe counties. It's been a real pleasure. I really appreciate your time, sir.
Well, I thank you for having me on. And again, we started talking about DACA. Hopefully DACA will still get through Congress. And as I said, what the White House released yesterday and today is a whole menu of policy propositions that can be negotiated, but I'd say let's negotiate it with a broader comprehensive immigration reform, and DACA is a little bit more boutique, a little bit more discreet. We can take care of that quicker.
A story that we, of course, will be following here in WLRN a lot. Archbishop Wenske, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, still to come, we're going to take a look at the idea of public beehives here in Miami. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Now, for years, the news about bees has centered on dying bee colonies. The bees are in trouble. Danielle Bender, a South Florida resident, wants to do something about that, and she wants to recruit you to help. And if you're afraid of bees, don't worry. She was two before she started working on her project. Now, she recently won a grant from the Miami Public Spaces Challenge to expand beehives around the county. And if you're afraid of bees, she'll be happy to give you a tour of her hives, and she'll help you overcome any fears that you may have. I spoke to her recently about this project and what she hopes to accomplish. Something happened to your beehives right before Hurricane Irma that you noticed. What was going on?
Just a crazy amount of activity. It was almost like, well, not almost like, they definitely understood that something was coming. They are able to pick up on the weather, and I just noticed a ton of activity, and I was wondering, oh man, are they gonna get ready to leave, or are they gonna be able to make it through this hurricane? And when I went to go check on my boxes afterwards, I was shocked and really excited to see that they didn't, you know, they received no damage, they weren't turned over, they didn't blow away. And when I opened them up, they were doing all of the things that I had been waiting for them to do. They had started capping all their honey. It was just like the box was bursting full of bees. So,
can you explain what is it, from what you understand about bees' behavior, that they understand something's coming and they thus prepare for it?
Yeah. I have to be completely honest. I have no clue. It totally shocked me. Like I've told you, I'm still learning about this whole process. So this was a first hurricane trial for me as a beekeeper. And now that I know what to expect, I guess I should be ready to harvest honey after every hurricane, maybe.
Earlier this year, you won the Miami Public Spaces Challenge, and it was for these beehives. Basically, now you're receiving what is essentially a grant to bring beehives to public spaces in Miami.
Yes.
Let's start with this, though. When you came up with this idea, you were terrified of bees.
Yeah, I'm not a big insect person, which is really funny that now I'm doing beekeeping. But yeah, I think most people are pretty scared of bees. When you think of bees, you think of My Girl and
the movie.
Yeah, it's just...
And in it, there was a scene.
Yeah, where he gets just stung and then ends up, you know, dying. So that is what I thought, and that's what a lot of people think. And it took a lot for me to even come up with this idea in a way that didn't feed into my own fears.
So all of a sudden, your mindset jumps onto this question of what's happening to bees, and now you're thinking about... What you could do to help?
Yeah, I'm thinking about what I can do to help, but then also realizing that I think there's a moment of imposter syndrome where I'm sort of like, well, how can I be doing all of this if I'm scared of them and I haven't even touched a beehive? I like see a bee in my backyard and freak out and run away. So I guess like imposter syndrome kicked in. I was like, well, I guess if this is actually of interest to people, I guess I need to learn a little bit about this and get hands-on.
Okay, it's one thing to say you want to learn something about it, but you still got to overcome that fear.
Yeah,
how
totally.
How did you do that?
Extensively looking up videos and understanding why bees do certain things the way they do. I think that if you just do a surface-level scratch, all you're going to read is, like, angry, attack. But if you go a little bit deeper and you realize, like, bees don't like when you're wearing all black. They don't respond well when you're wearing perfume. If you run and swat and act frantic, they're gonna come and chase after you.
All right, but now you have to actually get out there and be with the bees. So when was that first time and what was that like?
I was introduced to a beekeeper named Bianca Pretorius, who's also an artist. And she does backyard beekeeping and has a couple of hives. And so she allowed me to come... and watch her observe her hives. And that changed a lot for me because if I had started this on my own and just gone and gotten a hive, there would have been so much that I would have been freaking out about, not even safety-wise, but like, what are they doing? Why is this happening? And being able to stand behind someone that knew what they were doing.
Take me to that first time, though.
Okay.
The very first time you walk out there.
Okay.
What happened?
The very first time... She opened up one of her hives, which is almost as tall as me and has several layers. And just seeing a frame completely packed to the point where you can't even see the wood, just the bees are sitting there. And I don't know, there was no part of me that felt nervous or scared, because I realized they weren't coming towards me. They were just chilling and, you know, sitting on their frame. And she had mentioned, and I had also read it before, that there's a tool called the smoker, and you smoke the bee box, and it sort of neutralizes an alarm pheromone that they send out, where they're basically like telling the whole hive, like, panic, panic, why is this person opening this up? It sort of, you know, snuffs that, and then they go straight into, like, you know, this is one thing I like to say, sorry to, you know, jump ahead, but when I do have people that come to my hive, especially kids, the first thing I tell them is, you know, what's the first thing you would do if your house was on fire and you couldn't put the fire out? You'd go grab your favorite toy or your dog. You're going to grab the thing that's most important to you. So the bees are also doing that. They're smelling the smoke and they're like, uh-oh, guess we got to go grab some of our honey. So it becomes a thing where they're no longer really interested in you.
But do you remember the first time a bee landed on you, or a couple of them, maybe a bunch of them?
I think, yeah. I mean, that was actually the second time I went to Bianca's. She asked if I wanted to hold the frame while she was doing some manipulation. I can't remember specifically what. And the bees, from me holding the frame, just went and probably like 100, it felt like, just went on my gloved hand while I was holding the frame. And I had a tiny moment where I was thinking, oh my God, what are they doing? Are they going to sting me? Are they going crazy? And then I realized nothing's happening. I'm just like another landing strip for them right now. So
now all of a sudden you're working on beehives. You've overcome this fear. And when did you come up with the idea that this could be in public spaces and it would be beneficial to the community and to us? How?
Yeah, well, I came up with the idea of them being in public spaces before I even touched a beehive or even thought about this Miami Foundation Public Space Challenge being a success for my project. So I proposed the project just sort of like, you know, I work for an artist-run space, and we always are taking on strange proposals that utilize public space in different ways. So I thought, yeah, you know, why not? And then once, like I mentioned before, once I saw that people were commenting, I was like, oh, I guess this is actually maybe going to happen. I probably should start beekeeping.
So you have this grant, and the first part of it is just to get a couple of them set up.
Yes.
What's the plan? Where do you want to put them?
Well, right now we're looking at several different locations. I'm hesitant to mention all of them because we haven't 100% secured permissions. We're working to make sure they're 100% okay to be there. But the neighborhoods that we're looking at right now, we already have one in Little River. Those are my personal hives, but I completely open them up to the public and have different people come to visit them every single weekend with me. And then the other three locations we're looking at is Gladeview, another one off of Opa-locka, and then another one in Kendall. So I'm trying to make sure that they're not just like at the downtown core center. I want to make sure they're a little spread out.
And again, that's Danielle Bender. She is a South Florida resident who recently won the Miami Public Spaces Challenge. She wants to put public beehives around the county. And by the way, if you're afraid of bees, she welcomes you to come out and spend some time with her and her beehives. And she'll teach you more about them, and she'll help you overcome any fears you may have. We'll have a link, by the way, on our website later today. Well, that's the program for Monday, October 9th. Sundial is produced by Maeve McGoran and Polly Landis. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz. He was also pushing all the buttons today. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. And again, we'll have a link to today's program later today on WLRN.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. Talk to you tomorrow.